Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Stuart Brand founded the Whole Earth Catalog and inspired a generation to a lively ecological awareness. He's a big, big thinker. Now, Brand says he's not worried about the planet. He's worried about civilization being lost to global warming and resource wars. And he's calling for an emergency eco-pragmatism that sounds like anything but a back-to-nature dream. Nuclear power, biotech, giant cities, human engineering of the atmosphere, all ASAP. This hour on Point, Stuart Brand's new eye-opening manifesto, Eco-Pragmatism. We'll hear pushback in this hour on nuclear power from Amory Lovins, and environmentalist Bill McKibben will check in. You can join the conversation. Is Mr. Whole Earth caving here, or do we now have no choice but to manage nature? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A whole generation and more will know the Whole Earth Catalog very, very well. Just in case you missed it, here's Steve Jobs talking about Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog at the 2005 Stanford University commencement. He concluded his speech talking about the lasting influence of my guest today.
When I was young, there was an amazing publication called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was one of the Bibles of my generation. It was created by a fellow named Stuart Brand, not far from here in Menlo Park, and he brought it to life with his poetic touch. This was in the late 60s, before personal computers and desktop publishing, so it was all made with typewriters, scissors, and Polaroid cameras. It was sort of like Google in paperback form 35 years before Google came along. It was idealistic, overflowing with neat tools and great notions.
There, Steve Jobs on Stuart Brand. Stuart Brand joins us now. He's out with a new book. It's called Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. A pioneer in the environmental movement, played a big role in framing up our understanding of the information age. Stuart Brand, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you.
It's great to have you. I feel like I've been reading you all my life, and you never fail to be eye-opening, mind-opening, and that is very true in your new book. It's quite something, but you start right out saying you're not worried about the planet. One way or another, the planet will take care of itself. You're worried about civilization itself.
Well, certainly the planet in terms of a celestial body, that's going to be fine. And no matter how hot it gets, there'll be plenty of life around. There may not be so much of us around.
The prospect that you're raising here is that we may see global warming more dramatic and much sooner than people imagine, and you look back at history and say, that means resource shortages, that means war, that means civilizational collapse if we're not careful.
Well, the two I'm following here are James Lovelock, the Gaia Hypothesis guy, who has been looking at climate change in terms of basically a positive feedback that seems to be now in motion, and that can move very quickly when it gets going. The other person I'm paying attention to is archaeologist Stephen LeBlanc, who wrote this wonderful book called Constant Battles, which is about how humans have always fought in an organized way over resources. And whenever we bump up against carrying capacity or carrying capacity comes down on us, we fight over the resources and typically annihilate each other in large groups. We haven't done that in a few centuries, but as the droughts have shown in North Africa and in Darfur, that's the kind of thing that happens when things dry up.
And you could see it happening on a much bigger scale. You say it's time to reframe our environmental thinking for a new century, and some of that reframing is going to be jarring for environmentalists. What's the shift you're looking for?
Mainly toward more science. I think the reason that environmentalists have been so right so early about climate is they paid close attention to the climate scientists, and the ones who know the most there are the most worried. But in other areas, they don't pay attention to the scientists, and genetically engineered food crops, kind of a superstitious mode took effect, and in nuclear, a kind of a transfer of detestation of nuclear weapons shifted over to nuclear energy, and I think inappropriately. Generally, with nuclear scientists, the more they know, the less frightened they are.
And the whole back-to-nature notion of environmentalism, you're pushing away, saying it's too late for that, if that was ever the right answer.
It's certainly the right answer in terms of connecting with nature and feeling strongly to defend it. And that's something environmentalists have done superbly right along and need to continue. It's just adding to that more of a focus on science and then moving through that to a focus on engineering, which there's a term that came up in ecology in the last few years called ecosystem engineering. Mm-hmm. It's what earthworms do that make soil better. It's what beavers do when they make beaver ponds, and then it's a much richer habitat for everybody. And I work a lot in restoration. In a sense, that's what we do there. Luna Leopold inspired us, and it's a large-scale process now. And it looks like we may have to move up to taking that approach with climate, to restore the climate to a less fragile one. And that's part of the process for the next half century, century.
That is manipulating the seas, the skies, maybe to slow down the cooling or reverse it. Stuart Brand, I wish you'd take us down through your sort of big menu points and the eco-pragmatism you're outlining here and give your thumbnail rationale to begin with for why. Let's start with cities. Big cities are already a reality, and you say they're the new green sort of domicile.
Well, it may well be that cities are the greenest thing that people do. We're half of us in the world in cities now, on the way toward 80% by mid-century. And that means 80% of humanity on 3% of the land. When people concentrate in cities, they use less everything, less energy, less materials, and so on than when they're in the countryside. And especially in the developing world, where 5 out of 6 people live, the people that are moving to the cities typically are the ones that have been on subsistence farms, not participating in the cash economy, using up the woody plants around them for firewood, mm-hmm. and eating the animals for bushmeat and so on. So the move to the cities, both in the developed world and the developing world, has been good news environmentally.
Nuclear power, why that? Why not? People are talking solar, wind, micro, renewable. Why nuclear?
And nuclear. You go ahead on all of these other things, and the environmental movement's been great on pushing them. And there's a switch you see going on among many young environmentalists and some older prominent environmentalists to include nuclear in the mix because it is basically zero greenhouse gases for large quantities of baseload electricity, which is what you need to keep things going. One day we might have good solar storage. We might have good storage for wind power. We don't have that yet. Nuclear is a mature technology with amazing things coming in the next generation of stuff. So I say include it.
Include it because the challenge is urgent. Genetic engineering, genetically modified crops and all the rest. I heard you say recently environmentalists have been irrational, anti-scientific, and very harmful on this front. A lot have stood up at some cost trying to protect the purity of food sources. You say no.
Well, I guess wild fish and wild mushrooms are a pure source, but everything that we use for our agricultural food has been messed with genetically for 10,000 years in most cases. And a lot of the modern seeds are made by irradiating the seeds and then planting them, and whatever comes up you choose and among that. I'm a biologist by training, so while I changed my mind on nuclear from anti to pro, I would say that I've been puzzled by the opposition to nuclear, to genetic engineering with food crops, because it's the sort of thing that microbes have been doing for, 3.5 billion mm-hmm. years. Genes move laterally between species all the time. That we're doing it with some precision and a lot of close transparency and oversight is, I see, as good news.
And geoengineering on a planetary scale, you say you'd get in there, whether it's manipulating seas or sky, to change the climate, to slow down warming, like what? Like how?
There's about 8 or 10 different schemes just emerging for direct intervention in climate. One that climatologists like because they know it works is what happens when a volcano sends a lot of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, which happened in 1991.
Pinatubo.
And the Pinatubo explosion. And that cooled the Earth by half a degree Celsius for a year or two. And suddenly you had more polar bear cubs in the Arctic and the rest of it. According to the models, if you had a Pinatubo every year, that would cool the planet by 3 degrees Celsius, and that would stave off the worst effects of a lot of the ongoing increase in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. But all you really do is buy time, and so the approach I would like to see is very good research, very good engineering, have this as plan B on hand if things get desperate, which I think they may well do, and then deploy it with as light a touch as possible and as reversibly as possible. And do none at all, if possible. Do it temporarily, if possible. But we need to have it in hand.
I mean, I take your basic message as it's too late to go back to nature. Humanity must manage nature. You know, a lot of environmentalists aren't going to like that whole idea.
Well, we've been terraforming the planet for a long time now, affecting, 40% of the ice-free land areas and agriculture, and that changes it enormously. That's had some direct effects on climate in its own right. We are enormously affecting the atmosphere and the climate with our industrial civilization. And so it's too late to say we can't do terraforming because we already are. The problem is we're doing it badly. And I say if we're going to do it, we need to do it well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Whole Earth Catalog creator Stuart Brand about his new call for eco-pragmatism, urban life, nuclear power, biotech, and human engineering of the global climate. His new book is Whole Earth Discipline. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Amory Lovins, pushing back a little on the subject of nuclear power. John is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. John, you're on the air with Mr. Brand.
Yes, sir. I'm hitting 60. And I grew up in the 60s, and there was always this zero population growth, ZPG.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened to that? And I think Al Gore brought out a good point in his Inconvenient Truth documentary about the rising population. I think a lot of our problems would be solved if the population went down instead of up.
Let us pick it up. Stuart Brand, what about the human population backing off instead of plunging in to manage the planet?
Well, the good news is that thanks largely to cities and lots of other things, mainly the empowerment of women and better medicine everywhere, birth rate is dropping precipitously already in the developed world and moving very quickly in the developing world. So, it used to be that people were expecting 14 or 15 billion humans in this century, and right now, the expectations are to level off at 9 billion by mid-century. I think it may be lower than that. And it's basically a self-driving process. When women move to town, they get more independence. There's less need for so many children. They typically have one or two. Make sure that they're educated as part of moving up economically. And they have good access to medical facilities and so on in town. So urbanization, somewhat as a surprise to most demographers, defused the population bomb.
But you're talking about real population problems. Even so, if global warming comes on in ways we may not fully anticipate, one of those poll stars you follow here, James Lovelock, is looking at a scenario where the carrying capacity of a hotter Earth, he tells you, is less than a billion. It seems to me, reading your book, that's part of what's driving you here to go to radical solutions, because getting to 1 billion from where we are now would be one bloody business.
One bloody business. Yeah, the problem is that it isn't really climate that kills people. It's people killing people over issues that climate causes. And that's Lovelock's view, that with a 5 degrees Celsius hotter world, it stabilizes, but it stabilizes as it did 55 million years ago when you had crocodiles in the polar seas and the rainforests weren't there. And he says that's a carrying capacity for maybe a billion and a half humans, which is quite a lot of loss if we go from the 6.8 billion we have now. That's part of the urgency.
Is that, to your mind, a real possibility? In what time frame?
The reason that Lovelock bears down on positive feedback is, as we're seeing, for example, with the melting Arctic ice, is that these things amplify change very rapidly when they take off. And so when one does take off, it can move quickly. And so we're talking about having no ice at all in the summer in the Arctic decades ahead of what the IPCC models had suggested. Likewise, if the rainforests start melting like ice, turning to scrub, that can move very quickly because they generate their own rain, their own clouds. And once that gets going and goes, it goes quickly. I don't know what the time frame of that would be, but any time frame at all is horrendous to contemplate. Mm.
Stuart Brand's new book is Whole Earth Discipline. He's calling for an eco-pragmatism movement. It's kind of a manifesto. One of the elements of it is support for nuclear power. He's had some kind of public debate with Amory Lovins on that front. Amory Lovins, co-founder, chairman, chief scientist at the Rocky Mountain Institute, a big global thinker on energy. He joins us today. We're reversing locales here. Stuart's in Colorado. Amory Lovins is in New York City. He's with us now. Amory Lovins, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Say hi to Stuart Brand. I know you've known each other for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Greetings. Yeah, I was just in New York myself. You. Sorry we weren't there together.
Swapping places here. Amory Lovins, you've pushed back fairly hard and quite publicly on Stuart Brand's embrace here of nuclear power. Why?
Oh, because although Stuart and I share a great sense of urgency about climate change, I think the more urgent you think that problem is, the more important it is to invest judiciously to get the most solution per dollar and the most solution per year. And nuclear flunks both those tests. It gives about 2 to 20 times less carbon saving per dollar and about 20 to 40 times less carbon saving per year than if you bought instead the things that are walloping it in the market, namely micropower and energy efficiency.
What is micropower?
Micropower has two parts. One is renewables other than big hydro. So it's sun, wind, geothermal, small hydro, and so on. Mm-hmm. And the other part is cogenerating electricity and useful heat together in factories or buildings, which saves at least half of the fuel money and carbon.
So your core argument is not the nuclear waste argument, but a cost effectiveness argument around nuclear?
Correct. The nuclear is about the most expensive and slowest thing you can build. And I don't think it's true you need to build everything. You can't afford to build everything. You need to choose the best buys for your goal, just as in assembling a financial portfolio. You don't stuff it full of one of everything on the market. You figure out the diversified set of assets that will best meet your investment objectives. And if you buy something really expensive and risky, that actually makes your portfolio perform worse because you didn't get to buy stuff that would have performed better.
Stuart Brand, what about the argument? You're arguing a big push in nuclear. Amory Lovins says it's not your most cost-effective way forward, and it really matters what we pull the trigger on here.
Well, I was surprised in Amory's good and thorough response to the chapter, which I'm glad to see is out there, and it's downloadable from Rocky Mountain Institute. One of the things, Amory, you didn't address in that was micro-reactors. And delighted you're talking about micro-power because it looks like the new generation of small reactors down around 25 to 125 megawatts coming from half a dozen manufacturers are right in there and could do cogeneration and local adaptivity and all the things that you'd like to see distributed micro-power do.
Might have been a good idea to look at 50 years ago, but it's way too late. And actually, I did describe it. It's in reference 6 of the backup paper, because I wrote a special paper on this called New Nuclear Reactors, Same Old Story, last spring, because I got really curious about these arguments and dug into them. And there are two basic issues that, again, are economic that I get to before the other attributes. I think the Gen 4 reactor types are broadly comparable to today's reactors in waste production. They might in some respects be safer. They're generally as proliferative or more proliferative, but their economics are not sufficiently better to make any difference for two reasons. One is that, of course, what makes a reactor work is you have a very concentrated source of heat and also of radioactivity, and the physical devices you need to harness the heat and manage the heat and radioactivity do not scale down very well. It's a matter of physical scaling laws. Secondly,
Wait. Isn't that the case also with solar thermal? They're using the same thing. They're using small steam turbines.
To some degree, it's true of the steam turbine, except that there you don't have a concentrated source and you don't need shielding. Mm. And the mirrors are very well suited to scaling down and to mass production. The more serious problem, though, is one of timing, because the things you're competing with, or the things that all nuclear fails to compete with by large margins, are already getting their economies from mass production. They're things like photovoltaics and wind turbines. And they are decades further along in getting their scale economies. And then by the time you got some kind of new reactor that's usually been on the books for 40 or 50 years to be actually licensed, financed, built, tested, and then you scaled up production of it, you'd be more decades behind, at least one or two, the things that are already several times cheaper. In fact, if you were to take today's nuclear plants and make the nuclear part free, the other roughly two-thirds of the investment would still be grossly uncompetitive with efficiency and micropower.
Emery Lovins, Stuart Brand, if you'd be kind enough, I'd like to let some of our listeners in here. They have questions on this front. Let me go to Oak Bluff, Massachusetts, and Lloyd. Lloyd, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. In 1980, my father, George William Hart, who was working for the Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, as an engineer, chief engineer in their research department on electronics and software and computers, who developed most of the fail-safe systems that are on most Western nuclear power plants today, died of radiation poisoning. And his thyroid got wiped out, and his heart failed. And because of exposure of myself and my high school physics class, I have poor health, my sister has poor health. And when my father died, basically the core of our family was destroyed. And our family just fell apart and became, you know, horribly depressed. And, you know, our father was our
understandably.
He was a genius.
So what do you think of Stuart Brand's message today, Lloyd?
I fought for a very long time to get that recognized in the press in Canada. I finally did in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want, you know, Mr. Brand to address the issue of workers who work at a nuclear power plant, like my father did, work right by a nuclear power plant, and address the fact that the industry is lying about the health effects on workers and also the health effects on surrounding communities around. There are 2,400 incidents a year where radioactivity is released into the environment, and the industry lies about it.
Lloyd, it's a powerful personal story. Let us put it to Stuart Brand.
Let me ask Lloyd one quick question. Did some of your father's coworkers have a similar problem?
Yes. It's throughout the entire nuclear industry. Where people around nuclear power plants and that work in the industry all have radically increased health effects. Now, not everybody gets cancer. My father didn't get cancer from his exposure for over 16 years to radiation. He got glandular problems. His thyroid disappeared. So it's not like, you know, everybody gets the same disease from radiation. There's a lot of disease. Now, you go around Three Mile Island, they just looked for the most, you know, controversial disease, cancer. Well, had they looked further, they would have found a radical increase in glandular disease.
Lloyd, I thank you for your call. Stuart Brand, what about the safety issue when it comes to nuclear?
It's been very good. I mean, when this gentleman spoke about the people around nuclear reactors. They're polled every so often. What do you think about nuclear reactors? Would you like to have another reactor at the plant nearby? It's the most positive support that the industry gets is people that are closest to the industry out in the landscape. So at least all of the data from that shows that it's not so big an issue. But this guy has obviously had a tragedy, and I'm sorry about it.
Amory Levins, the safety aspect of nuclear.
I'm sorry, I don't have more specific information on what the caller's talking about, but I think we need to remember that although there are many honest and conscientious people in this industry that know they're dealing with serious matters, organizations are fallible, and just as individuals are, and they often do things that the individuals in them would not do by themselves. Historically, whenever you get a period like we've been in the last 8 years where there's a very pro-nuclear administration, and that sends all the signals against dissent and rocking the boat. This turns out to be bad for the nuclear industry because bad things end up happening that wouldn't have happened if we'd been more alert. And you get capture of the regulatory apparatus by the industry being regulated and so on. So I think the issues of human fallibility remain serious in this industry. I just don't tend to treat those first, because if the technology is unnecessary, uneconomic, and makes and actually reduces and retards climate protection, I stop there. I don't go on to whether it's proliferative or unsafe or whether we know what to do with the waste.
Amory, question. What do you make of the rather pro-nuclear stance of the current administration?
I think there are differing views within the administration, and I think the differences between our views are mirrored there, and that our discussion will be helpful in informing those internal debates. I think also a lot of the pressure comes from members of Congress more than members of the administration.
And the Democrats there, the powerful ones, are sounding more pro-nuclear every day with the climate
bill. John Kerry, Tom Carper, of course, Lindsey Graham in South Carolina.
Barbara Boxer, of all people, my senator.
There's a big story there. We're going to be paying more attention to it. Amory Levins, I know that's all the time we have you for today, but I thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Amory Levins.
And I thank Amory for a good criticism of the chapter. There's a lot in there, and we make different predictions that'll play out in different directions.
Indeed. It's an empirical question, and thank you, Stuart.
Amory Levins, Rocky Mountain Institute. Stuart Brand, who's going to win this argument, and how?
Phrase that again.
Well, Amory Levins represents a body of thought that says, no, don't go nuclear. You're pushing very strong, as are others right now. How do you think it will be determined whether or not we go ahead in significant measure with nuclear or not?
A couple of predictions that Amory makes in his criticism. One is he says that the current rebirth or growth of building reactors around the world and in the U.S. is what he calls a dead cat bounce. It's a sort of the last death throw of a dying industry. I think it's a live cat jump, and that instead of seeing a diminishing of new reactors everywhere, we will continue to see more and more, mainly because of climate change and also because of the technology getting better. He also, I think, predicts that Germany will shut down its 17 reactors, and I'm predicting that they're going to hang on to them because they have to.
Stuart Brand is with us. His new book is Whole Earth Discipline. We're getting a lot of response on Twitter. David says, I worshipped Stuart Brand in Whole Earth days, but his eco-pragmatism is absolutely nuts. No nukes or GMF. We'll come back and ask you about that and more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Whole Earth Catalog creator Stuart Brand about his new call for eco-pragmatism, a kind of emergency eco-pragmatism. His new book is Whole Earth Discipline. We're getting lots of feedback here. So Brand joins us today from Denver, Colorado. Here's a web posting at our website, onpointradio.org, from Colin. He says, I recently graduated from NYU with a BA in environmental studies. I've come to the same conclusions regarding energy and genetically engineered foods, which met with much resistance in classroom debates. I hope, he writes, for a new green revolution as much as anyone, but we can't remain entrenched in the environmental dogmas of the past. There is no time left for idealism, he writes. Let's go to Lilibet in Gladstone, New Jersey. Lilibet, you're on the air with Stuart Brand.
Yes, this angers me so much, this conversation, because I find it very presumptuous of him to make the statement that we need to control and manage nature. When we humans are on this earth just for a part time, and we need to take responsibility for our own selfish actions, because I find that we need to be accountable for our actions. We are the problem. We are the cause. And go nuclear and everything, temporary, forget it. If you're ill, you find out the cause, and you go and change. We have to change what we say, what we do, and we're responsible.
We hear it.
Boy, am I in agreement with that. That sounds like my program.
But you're saying manage nature, and she's saying that's presumptuous. In Whole Earth Catalog, you said we are as gods and might as well get good at it. Now you're writing in page one here, we are as gods and have to get good at it. Manage nature.
We've been managing nature for a long time. And if we just stop, we go ahead to the hot earth that doesn't have space for very many of us. So we either manage it badly or well. Well is going to take a lot more science, and that's the main thing I'm pushing in this book.
But Lilibet's saying go to the core issue. It seems like a kind of back-to-nature argument, which I hear you pushing against. But you can hear her passion with which she wants to get down to, basics. Let's stop leaving that footprint that leads us on this road to a fiery planet. She wants to go back to that. Is that?
I think that passion is dead right, and it's one of the best things the environmental movement has going for it. Your next guest, I think, is Bill McKibben, mm-hmm. and the Climate Action Day, I trust, will engage a lot of this passion and make the world aware of how many are concerned about this issue. I have a good question for McKibben if you want it.
We'll take a note. What have you got?
He's inspired by James Hansen, the climatologist, mm-hmm. who said we have to go back to 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Ask him about Hansen's views on nuclear, because Hansen is extremely pro-nuclear and worried about environmentalists slowing down the next generation of nuclear.
We will ask him. You write in Whole Earth Discipline, you say, if Greens don't embrace science and technology and jump ahead to a leading role in both, they may well follow the Reds into oblivion. They need to become early adopters of new tools and adventurous explorers of new situations instead of always saying no and stop. Their strategy can be to affirm and redirect. You really are deliberately trying to reframe the understanding of what environmentalism means here, but there's a lot of pushback in that community. How's your progress?
Well, I think the note that you just read from the student is mm-hmm. indicative. There is a generation gap going on here, which is that younger environmentalists or younger scientists and engineers generally with a green frame of mind are way more comfortable with a lot of these ideas and technologies than my older generation is. So in a sense, I'm much more at odds with my contemporaries than I am with the young people.
Let's go to Tom in Columbus, Georgia. Tom, you're on the air with Stuart Brand.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book called One Man's Wilderness, and it's the story of a man whose name was Richard Prinicky. And PBS did a documentary on him, and the documentary was called Alone in the Wilderness.
Yeah, I remember. Wonderful scenes of winter Alaska.
Yes, he moved to the Twin Lakes region mm-hmm. in Alaska at the age of 52 in 1967, and he hand-built an 11-foot by 20-foot long cabin, and he lived there by himself for 35 years until he was 87 years old. He only left that area, I think, around 2002.
And what question or observation does that lead you to for Stuart Brand?
Well, this is an example of truly back to nature. This is an example of a man who left practically no carbon footprint for those 35 years. He stuck his hands into himself and he stuck his hands into Mother Earth, and he treated Mother Earth the way Mother Earth is intended to be treated. the lady that just called that was so passionate about, with her concerns, I hope that she finds this story in this book and can watch this and read this. This is an example of a man who did this at a time when cell phones came along and TV came along.
Tom, what if that's not an option? There are 6 billion plus of us now. If we all go to the, you know, back country of Alaska, it will be a city.
Well, at the very least, people can do things like planting a garden in their backyard.
Hear, hear.
Instead of watering their front lawns when it's raining outside, they can
paint the roof white. Helps a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff like that. It adds up. You know, all of the individual actions that go in this direction, I think, are absolutely worth pursuing.
Tom, I appreciate your calling. Thank you very much. Stuart Brandon, but there it is again, the notion of a back-to-nature impulse inspiring environmentalism in a generation or maybe more that may not want to grasp science and technology as the answer, that may fear who's going to manage. You say we have to manage nature. Who's we?
Maybe we should be interviewing the billion people that live in squatter cities and slums that have come in from the countryside and ask them how wonderful it was out there in the countryside that they often in great difficulty and danger left that, moved to town, started creating their own jobs and their own houses and their own communities. Why did they leave? They were out there immersed in the countryside. That should have been wonderful. And they often speak romantically of the place, and they want to go back there, be buried there when they die. But the way of life they were stuck with there is not one that they want to keep living in.
We've only got you for a few more minutes. Speak to that environmental community that cares passionately about the ecology of the planet, but may resist your perspective here. I think they may need a little more argumentation toward your outlook.
I think one of the, when you look at global scale at all of this stuff, one of the principles that emerges is basically concentration of deleterious things. Concentrate people in cities, concentrate the waste from energy production in dry cask storage as we do with a very small quantity of nuclear waste rather than putting CO2 into the atmosphere by the gigaton. Concentrate agriculture into smaller areas, concentrate logging into plantations so you can leave more wild trees, concentrate fishing, which is strictly hunting at this point, move that more toward mariculture and aquaculture, and that frees up more of the ocean to remain wild and do its Gaian job of keeping the atmosphere balanced.
You paint a picture of humans increasingly concentrated in enormous urban centers, and the countryside, maybe going back to nature, but in a way without humans or without so many of us.
Say that again?
Well, of nature rising as, in its own domain as humans concentrate in urban areas is a picture you're painting here, that the countryside actually becomes does go back to nature a bit as humans concentrate in their millions and billions in the cities.
One astonishing fact that I ran across in the research for this book was that it is terrible that we are still cutting down large quantities of primary rainforest, but it turns out that 55 times more than we're cutting down is growing back as second growth rainforest. It grows back very rapidly in the tropics, and the various species come back into it in a period of a couple decades. And that's happening because people are moving out of the countryside into the cities. And a lot of marginal agricultural areas are going wild. And so that may be part of the mysterious drawdown of carbon from the atmosphere that climatologists are still wondering about. And that's fantastic news, in my view.
You write, in conclusion, ecological balance is too important for sentiment. It requires science. The health of natural infrastructure is too compromised for passivity. It requires engineering. And you write, what we call natural and what we call human are inseparable. We live one life. Do you think environmentalists...
You read that very well. You should have done the audio version of this book.
Sure. But do you think environmentalists are going to lift that flag or oppose it?
We live one life is a pretty bright green flag.
Science, engineering, and environmentalism, will they go? Will they follow you on this eco-pragmatist path? Is it an open question or not?
Yeah, I think the pragmatism requires that we really know what's going on and have way better science on how ecology actually works. It's not a predictive science yet. And to get there involves doing a whole lot more science, because as we're a big part of how ecology functions, we have to know how our function fits into those natural systems, and we don't yet.
It's a bracing view of the world, whole earth discipline, and eco-pragmatist manifesto by Stuart Brand. He joined us today from Denver, Colorado. Stuart Brand, thank you very, very much for being here.
Thank you. It's an honor.
In a moment, we'll hear from environmentalist Bill McKibben about his climate campaign. This is On Point. This Saturday, October 24th, environmental advocates around the world are celebrating an International Day of Climate Action. They expect about 1,000 events from Australia and the Middle East to the U.S. Bill McKibben founded 350.org, which is running the global climate campaign. He's a well-known environmental writer and journalist. 350 is the maximum number of parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that many scientists believe could maintain a stable Earth climate. Bill McKibben joins us now. Bill, thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom, always a pleasure.
We'll get to your event, but first, you're right on page one of Stuart Brand's new manifesto. He's citing you on page one.
Are you
on board? Are you an eco-pragmatist? What about James Hansen and his support for nuclear?
What Jim said about nuclear power, and I think it's incredibly pragmatic, is let it compete with everything else on the basis of cost. We're in a huge emergency now. If we can do nuclear power safely, then it's an option we've got to consider. But the as I'm looking at what Hansen wrote in the New York Review of Books, a gradually increasing carbon tax will favor nuclear power as well as renewable energies and energy efficiency, but taxpayers should not be saddled with funding subsidies of nuclear power. We are in such a huge emergency that we can't afford to take missteps. We've got to let markets do a lot of the work, and if that's pragmatic, then so be it. But the key step to making those markets do that work is a political step. It's to get the governments of the world to finally put a serious cap on carbon. We have our best chance at Copenhagen, though it's only a reasonable chance at best.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to change the odds of that on Saturday. In fact, there'll be 4,000 rallies and protests and demonstrations. They'll be happening in 170 countries. It'll be the most widespread day of political action on any topic in the planet's history. And it's all around a fairly obscure scientific number, a parts per million atmospheric concentration of CO2.
Where are we in that atmospheric concentration now, Bill? If that's the target,
That's the question you don't want to know the answer to. We're at 390 parts per million now. 2 years ago, a NASA team led by Hansen, and since then many others, have published studies that the original one said any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed or to which life on Earth is adapted. We're past it. That's why the Arctic is melting. It's why Australia is drying up and blowing away. And it's why, finally, there's a real climate movement emerging. We've had no money or anything else to make this happen. It's not my charisma that's allowed us to gather 4,000 events around the world. It's simply that so many places now, people can sense what's going on, and they're urgent to take action. And people are not only coming to it with real political will, they're coming to it with great beauty and creativity.
So a lot of these are going to be fun and celebratory, but what with the bottom line goal of putting global political pressure on leaders to actually act at Copenhagen late at the end of the year?
Look, here's the bottom line. Our political leaders spend a lot of time worrying about political reality. That's okay. That's their job. But we need them to understand that the real bottom line is about scientific reality. That is, the negotiation that's underway is superficially between China and the EU and the US, between industry and environment, between eco-pragmatists and whatever people who aren't eco-pragmatists are, on and on and on. The real negotiation that's underway is between human beings on the one hand and physics and chemistry on the other. And that is a tough negotiation. Physics and chemistry don't haggle. They don't say, oh, realize you're in a bit of an economic tough patch. Let's suspend the laws of nature for a decade or two. They do what they're going to do. They've stated their bottom line, 350 parts per million CO2, if you want the planet to work anything like you're used to it working. If we can't meet that, then all the rest of this is just talk and selling books and whatever else.
There's been some people already writing off Copenhagen. What are your realistic hopes for what might happen there, and how if it goes your way, how would it push us toward that 350 parts per million goal?
Tom, we're definitely not going to get a perfect agreement out of Copenhagen or anything close to it. What we need is for it to be a beginning, not an end. I was in Kyoto, and I watched people walk away after Kyoto and leave the issue alone for 6 or 7 years. We're out of 6 or 7 years as to waste. We need to, at the very least, make people understand that this has to happen now in profound ways, and Copenhagen will be a forum for doing that. The biggest forum will be this weekend, and there are wherever you are listening to this, there's something happening near you, and you can find out about it at 350.org.
Give us a couple of examples of what's going to be going on, Bill.
Here are a few of my favorites. In the Mideast, I was in Bethlehem a couple of weeks ago for a meeting. The Israeli activists are going to make a huge, giant human three on their shore of the dwindling Dead Sea. The Palestinians, a giant human five on theirs. The Jordanians, a giant zero. Sort of making the point, in a sense, that we've got to start laying aside some of our other preoccupations and ideologies. There'll be things like that happening from stem to stern of this planet. It's going to be an amazing day. Let's hope we didn't wait too late to get started.
350, right across the Dead Sea and into Jordan. Bill McKibben is founder of 350.org. Their International Day of Climate Action is this Saturday, October 24th. Bill, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you as always, friend.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.